A new Prometheus myth for the modern world.
Most people don't have the ability to be self-aware, the thing that he's offering. And so his job is to find somebody who can be self-aware, to give them this flame, and then to pass on and allow humanity to become its own God.
That's Walter Mosley. We'll talk to him about his two new novellas, The Gift of Fire and On the Head of a Pin. And more people are living alone and liking it.
I have to tell you, when I started this book, the original idea was that it would be called Alone in America, right, which is a really different concept than going solo. People in the modern world live alone wherever and whenever they can afford to do it.
That's Eric Klinenberg. His book is Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Walter Mosley is one of America's most prolific and eclectic writers. Best known for his E.Z. Rollins detective novels like Devil in a Blue Dress, he's also the author of nonfiction works like What Next? An African-American Initiative Toward World Peace, screenplays, short stories, and speculative fiction. We're privileged to have Walter Mosley as our guest today, talking about his latest works, two novellas of speculative fiction, The Gift of Fire, and On the Head of a Pin. Both works are modern myths. Gift of Fire is a kind of sequel to the Greek myth of Prometheus, set in the present time. In the ancient story, the Titan Prometheus was punished by the gods for bringing man the gift of fire. Prometheus was bound to a rock. Every day, his immortal body was devoured by a giant eagle. But in Mosley's The Gift of Fire, Prometheus is unbound and walks from his prison into present-day South Central Los Angeles. There, he finds a young man to pass a higher kind of knowledge to, a spiritual fire that sparks a movement to save the world. Mosley's second novella, On the Head of a Pin, is also enriched by mythic elements, as we hear. Walter Mosley, I'm so thrilled to have you here on Writer's Voice. You have these two novellas, these two speculative fiction novellas, On the Head of a Pin and The Gift of Fire. And they're both modern myths in a way, maybe The Gift of Fire more so. But I'd like to talk about On the Head of a Pin first. This was a spellbinding story. It involves the invention of a device that seems truly magical, a device you describe as a gossamer sail that promises to change the world of entertainment, but it actually promises to change a lot more than that. What is a sail? Describe it, and where is it?
Well, it's a device. It's a man-made, actually hand-woven device, you know, made from materials that, you know, that supposedly transfer light laser data that people hope that they'll be able to use to make any kind of movie. Like, you won't need actors anymore. Like, you'd only need them for a few minutes. Come in and, you know, show us the range of your acting, and then we can make the movie from that. Not only would they be able to do that, to be able to, you know, to take old actors, you know, Wallace Beery and Rudolph Valentino and all kinds of other people, and put them together and make movies with them in kind of fictional forms, making fictional films, which is, you know, that's the goal. What happens, however, is that through human interaction, the sail actually communicates to dimensions outside of the normal perception of humanity. And different people have different reactions to the sail, but my main character has a very deep connection with it and can not only see things that have happened in the past and in the future and in other places, but can actually communicate with certain beings beyond our realm. Of course, the federal government doesn't like that very much, and trouble ensues.
And I should say we're talking about this on a day when Julian Assange has just been denied his bid to avoid extradition to Sweden. So one can imagine the connections between the power of the state, and some of the things that you're saying in this wonderful novella, On the Head of a Pin. In the book, you talk about how the sale has shifted reality from the tangible to the make-believe. Could you deconstruct that a little bit?
Well, the tangible is the world that we believe in. And the intangible is what we can't understand. And what the sale does is it connects us to places and in ways that we can't understand. It connects us to ourselves. It connects us to the past. It connects us with other living beings that have, you know, different views and understandings of the world and the universe. And so what's tangible or what's real is, you know, as you know, they say in Buddhism, kind of illusion. And what the sale does is it unmoors us from that, our sense of that illusion is real, and connects us with possibilities that we can't really accept.
Yeah, and you also say it contains, this gossamer sale contains the impressions of everything that has ever lived. Where did this idea come from?
Well, you know, I mean, there are a lot of different ways. You know, when you're thinking about the world or about existence, you know, because we approach the world as if it was tangible, and whatever is tangible is causal. I mean, you know, something happens and something else happens and something else happens. But if you believe that, there's an impossible basis that there was a first event. It's impossible in a causal universe to have a first event. Everything has to be together. Everything has to be as one. So there are a lot of people, a lot of science fiction writers who've, like, you know, conceived of that. I think Michael Moorcock, the English science fiction writer, certainly talks about it a lot. But lots of people do. And what my imagination is that there's everything is happening all at once.
So this is,
and we're only at a certain moment in that.
Right. I mean, it's an idea that connects both to the deepest spiritual traditions as well as to modern physics. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah. Well, at some point or another, I think that in this book, they come together.
Say more about that.
Well, that at one point, our narrator says, you know, I don't know the difference between science and religion, because I'm seeing things and experiencing things, but there's no way for me to make them make sense. They're just happening, which is really our experience in the world, but we pretend as if it's not.
It's our experience in the world?
Well, yeah, like if you hold a glass, you know, you say, well, I know what this glass is. I said, well, yeah, you know what it is, but you don't know where it came from.
Yeah,
you understand what I'm saying? And so, you know, you can say, I can use it, I can utilize the glass, but its existence is beyond me.
You know, it's the narrator describes this as a holy experience, but he also says it has the dimension, it has the intentions of poetry. And I loved that connection there, a holy experience and intentions of poetry. What's the link there?
Well, I think one of the things in poetry that happens is that many things happen all at once. In a line of poetry, like if there's a line of poetry that you're reading, and I think that there's like a dimension of poetry beyond the written word or even the spoken word. But what the poet tries to do is bring all of those things about that glass or the sky or that flower into existence, like bring all the various planes of it into existence all at once, all the things that we're seeing and experiencing. And I think that's the job of poetry. And poetry is like a state of being beyond being, you know, some kind of ability that people have to write or to think or to display their intelligence or the depths of their emotions. And that's what the sale does.
And everyone experiences it differently.
Yeah, everybody's different. Everybody sees it differently. Some people can hardly see it at all. It's just an image, a flat image on a screen. So they might see something happening again and again and again, you know, that kind of repetition. That's one thing. And on the other hand, they might get deeply into it and experience what other people and times have experienced.
There's a guy in the story, a man named Pincus, mm-hmm. the, quote, thin-lipped racist, and he is brought to a psychotic state.
Yeah, well, his life is based so much on hatred, which, you know, you experience in the novel as racism, but, you know, it's something way beyond that. He's just very angry, and he's very upset, and he's deeply dissatisfied by life because of some experience that he's had that he doesn't know, that he's forgotten. And what the sale keeps trying to do is to remind him of what this is. And, you know, he can't bear it, because to see who he really is, what his life really was, is too much for him.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Walter Mosley about his latest works of fiction. They're two novellas in one book, On the Head of a Pin and The Gift of Fire. So in these novellas, both of them, but now in the one we're talking about right now, On the Head of a Pin, you're also talking about political dimensions. You know, we have Pincus, who is a racist, but also, as you've just said, the roots of his psychosis go deeper than that. That's more a symptom of his psychosis.
Right.
There is, ultimately, the state intervenes in the sale. They intervene to control it. What are you saying here? What's happening, and why?
Well, it's a very, like, interesting problem, because at one point you can talk about the world being illusion, and, you know, it's a very different kind of place and a different kind of thing, and you know, that we can't, you know, define reality. But on the other level, you know, we live every day. We have to eat and drink, and, you know, and feel safe, and, you know, have an orderly, you know, society, or somewhat orderly society. The problem, of course, is as at what point does the government have a right to control how you live, and what point doesn't it? And as the world gets bigger and bigger, people necessarily get smaller and smaller, and the government more and more believes and feels justified in controlling the lives of its citizens, and even the citizens of other places. A piece of technology like the sail represents a threat to society. It represents a threat that they don't even know, but it also represents a threat with people being able to glean information about the past or about the future or about the world in general that nobody else would have. And the government doesn't want just, you know, everyday citizens to have that. This is something that has to be controlled by a central organizing force. And so the government takes it over.
And so on one level, it's almost a kind of super WikiLeaks.
Yeah, well, right. It's like the universe is, like, all of a sudden open. Like, you can know what's going on in the universe. And of course, that's not acceptable. Or maybe it is acceptable. You know, I don't even know the answer to that question. I know that, you know, my main character, Josh Wennerlund, thinks that the government has no right to control what he feels and what he knows to be right.
It seems like it's an almost inevitable intervention, even for more than the question of information. It's as if the state cannot tolerate anything that it can't control, anything that is this powerful that it can't control.
Yeah, well, it's a big fear, you know. I mean, the United States and Russia and China and various other places spend a great deal of their time trying to dominate those points of view and those ideas, which are antithetical to what whoever is in control at that time thinks is the right way to be. So, you know, you have China coming down on different kinds of, you know, beliefs and systems and technology. You have McCarthy in America. You know, you have Hitler in Germany. At any particular time, there are acts and actions and beliefs of people which seem threatening to, you know, those people who are dominant. And the problem, of course, with people who are dominant is that the older, you know, they're usually the older people, and the older you are, the more you live in the past. And so you have this notion that people are not living today in today's technology into what's necessary and needful for the technique and the interaction of people today, and wanting to hold things back.
It puts me in mind of 1968, which, when I was young, and the motto of one of the mottos of the French uprising, "All power to the imagination," one of the slogans. This story very much gives a spiritual power to the imagination. And also,
it does indeed.
Yeah. And also the next story, "The Gift of Fire," even more, I'd say, even more clearly talks about what you've just mentioned, that is, the ideas that the state needs to control. This is a story of Prometheus updated. Why did you choose Prometheus as your mythic icon here?
Well, you know, in religion, he's one of the most, you know, outside of Buddhism, he's one of the most interesting deities who actually is objective in his approach to humanity. He comes down and he gives us knowledge, period. That's it. Nothing, no Garden of Eden that you can get kicked out of, no set of rules that you must follow to be, you know, a right living person, no limit on what you can or cannot do with that knowledge. He just gives you knowledge. And with that knowledge, you can decide to become or not become whatever you're capable of.
And he's horribly punished for that.
Yes. He is. It's one of the interesting things, you know, about I guess it's Hellenic religion, where the god that brings awareness to humanity is tortured for doing that because the gods are jealous.
And the gods are almost like the state in this story, The Gift of Fire. Is that right? Would you?
Well, the state is like the state, and the gods are like the state. And you know, certainly, you know, the idea of freedom is frightening to anyone who represents either, you know, governmental power or bureaucracy.
Right.
Because governmental power and bureaucracy are based on rules. You say, well, these are the rules. This is what you do. This is what you don't do. This is what you can do. This is what you can't do. This is what's right. This is what's wrong. Period. And, you know, the idea that you can start making those decisions on your own it's just terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Now, Walter Mosley, in this story, The Gift of Fire, Prometheus frees himself and he finds himself in South Central Los Angeles. How does he get there, and what is his what happens to him to begin with?
Well, actually, he's freed by fate. Really, he doesn't free himself. He's freed by fate, but he takes advantage of it, and he comes to Earth because there's two fires. The first is just general knowledge, and then there's underneath that there's an awareness of what to do with that general knowledge, how one can utilize that general knowledge. The first fire that he gave to humanity, you know, 2,000 years before, has greatly waned. It's weakened. You know, the structures are left, but people, you know, don't really trust their knowledge, and most people don't have the ability to be self-aware. The thing that he's offering, and so his job is to find somebody who can be self-aware, to give them this flame, and then to pass on, and allow humanity to become its own gods.
And so he meets a severely crippled black boy in South Central Los Angeles who has a hero's name, Chief Reddy.
Mm-hmm.
This turns into a true hero's journey, kind of in the sense of Joseph Campbell's. You know, the characters are iconic rather than, you know, psychologically based. Tell us a little bit about Chief Reddy, what happens to him.
It's interesting because I think that if you were talking to him, his awareness, he's aware of what we can be. So, you know, the like Chief Reddy alone would be meaningless and powerless by himself.
Mm-hmm.
But his ability is to bring a certain kind of awareness and connectivity between people, some people. And so he's like a whole group, you know. He has a, you know, he has an uncle, he has a girlfriend, he has a mother. There's a crazy guy who hangs out in the neighborhood that, you know, that becomes his friend. There's a wolf that he comes across on the way. There's a woman who, you know, was once a prostitute, but who, you know, who was HIV positive, comes to him for help. And together with you know, this kind of motley group, they travel around, you know, the country and hopefully the world at some point, and allow people to understand that they don't have to live the lives they've been living, that they don't have to be limited by, you know, those governmental and bureaucratic notions of what life is, even those economic notions of what life is, which are really, you know, much more threatening to us, because, you know, there's no way to control relationships as they are formed by economic interaction. Except Chief Reddy says, well, you don't have to do that. Just stop going to work. You know, let a few people go to work, and the rest of you, you can stay here, you can grow a farm, you can do this, you can do that. And people, he's saying, you can live a different kind of life if you can decide to live that different kind of life.
And he ignites a kind of spark,
mm-hmm.
right in the
literally.
Heart. Right,
yes.
Exactly. This is the fire. This is the second fire.
Right.
And, you know, as I was reading this on page 85, Chief Reddy is giving a speech, and he says to the people, you must come together, look in each other's hearts for a light to guide you, talk about the world and what you want and what is right. And I couldn't help but think about Occupy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny how that, you know, I mean, I wrote this book like 5 years ago, so
mm-hmm.
it couldn't have been influenced by that, but yes. But, you know, I mean, Occupy Occupy is a modern and kind of unself-reflexive anarchist movement. And anarchism, not being, you know, guys throwing bombs and blowing up stores, but or you know, government buildings, but people who you know, who believe that the individual, that government or society is based on the individual and individuals dealing with each other, not on superstructures controlling how the individuals deal with each other. So that's that's what he's talking about. I mean, he is you know, I mean, even the notion of fire. He is an anarchist, and that's why everybody's so afraid of him, or either is why they are afraid of him or why they love him, one or the other.
And yet he's also a Christ-like figure. I mean, in some ways, this is very much a Christian allegory in spite of the Greek origins of Prometheus.
Well, when you follow, and I try to do that in the earlier part of the book, when Prometheus goes back to Egypt, you know, to the Egyptian gods, and talks to them, and, you know, and he identifies, you know, gods that came before him, you know, because, I mean, you know, Jesus wasn't the first. I mean, he's not the first. You know, one of the problems is if you come out of a Christian culture, it's almost impossible not to think that everything starts with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there were images of him well before, you know, and, you know, messiahs and saviors and all kinds of, you know, people who came, preaching one gospel or another in order to change people and in order to work against the structures of government, which then was equivalent to the structures of religion. So, yeah, it is, but the Christ story comes out of other stories.
Right, right, with the sacrifice and the
mm-hmm.
resurrection. But this story also has a satanic character, Luther, a man who, in some ways, who also has been transformed by society into hatred. I mean, hatred is what rules his life.
Yeah, well, there are various evils in the world that even once the Chief Reddy is able to overcome his, you know, the gods, he still has to deal with, you know, some innate evil in the human soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, So there's, and of course, if people are going to be living, you know, more in an individual based world, they're going to be more vulnerable. Somebody has to do is put together an army, mm-hmm. and you know, you have trouble. You know.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying the anarchists are weaker in a way because of the democratic or the horizontal
because of their moral standing.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a moral standing, if you know what's right, if you know what's right, then you're in trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a pretty. That's a tough lesson, isn't it? That's a hard lesson,
and also a beautiful one. So, you know,
beautiful in what way?
Well, I mean that if you actually, you know, have a moral structure in your mind, and then you live by that structure, it's kind of wonderful. I mean, you're actually doing what you want to do and what you think is right. And you know this is the big challenge in the modern world. You know, people, you know, we keep on doing what we think is wrong and hope it turns out right. You know, and at the whole time we're completely convinced, yeah, but we're fighting this war, yeah, we're killing these people, yeah, things are bad. I was talking to a friend the other day. It was so funny because we've known each other for, like, you know, since the hippie days, but he didn't understand that, you know. So, well, you know, yes, people are getting killed in Afghanistan, and yes, many of them are innocent, but we aren't doing that on purpose.
Mm.
It's collateral damage.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's like, well, we are doing it on purpose because we're doing it and we know we're doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not collateral damage if somebody shoots your mother in the head.
Yes, I was reading the New York Times report, excellent report, yesterday, as we're talking with in this interview today, about how Obama signs off on every assassination that is done by the drones, the CIA, etc. You know, as if... You know, I'm sure there are some who would feel that, and I'm sure he thinks that that's the more moral decision, that somehow because he's taking responsibility, he is more moral. And yet I looked upon that in horror.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something of what you're saying here?
Well, it's exactly what I'm saying, someone was telling me, well, you know, Obama made the really hard decision, you know, to kill, you know, Osama bin Laden, you know, which, you know, listen, I understand why, and, you know, I don't know what I would have done in that situation, blah, blah, blah. But the hard decision, of course, would be, a hard decision is always not to do something,
mm-hmm.
you know, not to do it. And regardless of what you think, you know, what anyone thinks, what anyone decides to do in life, you have to at least speak the truth to yourself. You say, well, okay, fine, I did this, and other people are glad that I did it and are happy that I did it and think that I did something good and right and all this other stuff. But you have to know for yourself whether you did something good and right.
Right.
You know, and you have to look at the larger picture. And you also have to look at the way you're justifying yourself in the world, you know. You know, I wrote a book a while ago, you know, called What Next? You know, criticizing America's so-called war on terrorism, which hasn't changed since then. It came out the day we invaded Iraq, but the second time. And I'm saying, look, if the idea is that, you know, America has decided to assassinate all, you know, terrorists, that's fine, but it has to be all of them. It can't just be the ones we don't like.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, if you know, if that's like saying, well, we're gonna, you know, we've decided on the death penalty for murderers, but only for murderers who kill people we don't like,
right.
Or we do like, you know, not for people who kill people we don't like. You know, I mean, that kind of notion. You know, once you have a law, once you have a rule, you have to follow it. And I think that's what, you know, Chief Reddy would say. It's like, whatever decision we make, whatever you know, we try to do, we have to apply it with an even hand. And that becomes the most difficult thing because, you know, I mean, we live in America. If you have, you know, $1 billion, then you're going to get better legal representation and you're going to get more government than somebody who has no dollars.
Exactly. I wanted to just to ask you in the, you know, last few minutes of this interview, Walter Mosley, this is a book of speculative fiction. You've written some other speculative fiction as well, but you're most known for writing the E.Z. Rawlins detective novels.
Mm-hmm.
What do you like about doing speculative fiction as opposed to doing detective novels and vice versa? I mean, what What do they allow you to do? What does each genre allow you to do?
Well, I think the last part of the question is like the salient part, because I mean, yes, I write mystery, you know, or crime fiction. I write speculative or science fiction or fantasy, whatever you call it. I also write, like I said before, at least, you know, non-fictional monographs, mostly political, but one about how you write a novel. I write, you know, short stories and literary fiction and erotica. And, you know, I mean, I write all kinds of stuff. And the reason that you write different kinds of things is because, you know, you're trying to tell different kinds of stories. So in a book like Blue Light, when I'm trying to talk about, you know, a person who's, you know, basically not, you know, religious, but who believes in the soul, so I have to write a book outside of any kind of religious rubric explaining what a soul is to me. And so that, you know, I'm not going to write a mystery for that. You know, you just find a detective trying to find a soul. That would be kind of silly, you know. So speculative fiction becomes, you know, the form. You know, if I want to talk about how I think that, you know, economics and capitalism and, you know, work in antithesis to democracy, then I'm going to have to write something nonfiction, because otherwise, you know, I just get, you know, get lost in the middle of it. You know, so depending on what I'm trying to do, that's the genre I write in. And, you know, of course, you know, we live in America, and America is capitalist, and the central motion and capitalism is the production line. And even though most people in America think they're middle class, they're really working class. And when you're in the working class, you work on the production line, no matter what you do. So one of the things is, you know, as a writer, as a mystery writer, you know, my publisher says, well, that's what you do. You can't write these other books. You know, and they've, you know, literally tried to stop me, which is why I've changed publishers so many times, because people come to me and says, well, you know, we can't publish this book. We have to publish, you know, a book that's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I go, no, that's not true. And, you know, and so that's the kind of war that I've been in, you know.
Well, I am so glad that you've stuck to your guns on this one, because these are just two wonderful novellas that I've read here. And now I'm going to go and look for some of your nonfiction as well to follow up on. Walter Mosley, these are The Gift of Fire and On the Head of a Pin. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's great.
Walter Mosley is the author of more than 37 books and the winner of numerous awards, including an O. Henry Award, a Grammy, and Pen America's Lifetime Achievement Award. You can read an excerpt from Gift of Fire at writersvoice.net. Next up, we switch gears to talk with Eric Kleinenberg about going solo. Stay tuned after the break.
I declare this whole world is in a bad condition. I declare this whole world is in a bad condition. I declare this whole world is in a bad condition. I guess I better make a move. I better move. Yes, I better move. Bad condition, I declare this old world is in a bad condition. I declare this old world is in a bad condition. I guess I better make a move. I better move. Yes, I better move.
Oh, your mama's sick and dying.
Wow, wow.
And old Pa is even worse.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 1950, only 22% of American adults were single. Today, more than 50% of American adults are single, and 31 million, roughly one out of every seven, live alone. People who live alone make up 28% of all U.S. households. That makes them more common than any other kind of domestic unit, including the nuclear family. In his newest book, Going Solo, sociologist Eric Kleinenberg proves these numbers are more than just a passing trend. They're evidence of a revolutionary shift in human history. We're learning to go solo and crafting new ways of living in the process. Eric Kleinenberg, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Nice to be here.
Well, I hugely enjoyed going solo. One reason being that I'm one of the people you describe in the book. I'm a singleton, and I've enjoyed it for most of my life, I'd have to say. This is a fascinating book, and in many ways you paint a far from bleak picture of us singletons, those people who live alone. But you got started on this subject by an event that actually showed the terrible toll that living alone can take on people.
That's right. My way into this was through my first book, a story about a heat wave in Chicago where hundreds of people died alone. And when I started the research for Going Solo, I thought this would be the natural follow-up to that, that I would tell a story about our disconnection, our atomization, the way in which our communities have fallen apart and we have become more vulnerable because of that. Let me say that it is true that many people live alone and do get isolated, and I'm concerned about their fate. But what I discovered is that my premise going into it was wrong. People who live alone are typically more connected to friends and to neighbors than people who are married. They're more socially active in public areas like bars and restaurants and cafes. They go out to public events more often, and they're even more likely to volunteer in civic organizations. So my story changed with the facts.
And why do you think that's so?
Well, there's a difference between living alone and being alone. A lot of people today want to live alone because they don't want to live with the wrong person. They might be interested in getting married or moving in with the right romantic partner, but they're not interested in settling for someone who won't be good in their home. And so they live alone, but they want to be connected. And so they put themselves out in the world to form relationships.
And you also point out that this is happening with more and more people, not just in the U.S., but around the world, including in some of the emerging economies in China and India. This is a really revolutionary shift.
It's a huge shift. I argue it's the biggest social change of the last 60 years that we have failed to name or identify. We can connect to it either through our personal experiences or because someone in our family or our friendship circle lives alone, and we wonder what's happening with them. I have to tell you, when I started this book, the original idea was that it would be called Alone in America, right, which is a really different concept than Going Solo. And I just told you how wrong I was about the alone part of the story, but I was also really wrong about the America part of it. You know, I thought this was about our culture of rugged individualism and our religion of self-reliance. But it turns out that the United States is a laggard when it comes to living alone. We do it less than they do in most of Europe, especially in Scandinavia, where there's more than 40% of households as one-person households at the national level. And it's even more common in family-centric Japan than it is in the United States. So this is not a U.S. phenomenon at all.
So what is this about? Why do you think Japan and Northern Europe is able, well, actually, I gave it away a little bit, is able to do it more than we are?
Well, people in the modern world live alone wherever and whenever they can afford to do it. I'm surprised to be hearing myself say that, but it turns out to be true. You find it in places where there's a market economy that distributes wealth widely. You also find it in places that have good welfare states, places that subsidize housing and guarantee health care and home care and public transportation and make the streets safe. In places like this, the collective investment in common goods gives people the capacity to live the way they want to. It gives them the human security to live the way they want to. And so what I've discovered is that it's our interdependence that makes our independence possible.
So unpack this a little bit for us. You say that there is a combination of the rise of the concept of the individual along with four other sweeping social changes, changes in the status of women, the communications revolution, mass urbanization, and longevity. Let's take women first. Talk a little bit about how changes in women's status has contributed to this rise of living alone.
Well, you can't understand the rise of living alone outside of the rising status of women since the middle of the 20th century. In fact, There are many nations that have high levels of affluence, but very little independence for women. Places like Saudi Arabia, where very, very few people live alone. When women enter into the paid labor force, they gain the ability to delay marriage, and now women and men marry later than ever before, and also to get out of bad marriages through divorce without worrying about sentencing themselves to a lifetime of poverty or moving in, having to move in with their family members, which is what they would have done 60 years ago. So women's economic independence coupled with their sexual independence and their control over their own bodies and lives has been a huge force in this story.
Mm. And what about the communications revolution? I assume you think that you're saying that that has made us more flexible, more we're able to access people better.
Well, what the communications technologies of the 20th and 21st centuries did is they made it possible to be home alone, but also connected to other people and to ideas like never before. Think of the telephone and what it allows someone to do when they're living at home, or the television set. Now add to that the resources we have today, things like Skype and email and instant messaging and Facebook and Meetup and Craigslist and the internet. Go on and on and on this. We now live in a world where you can be home alone and engaged in profoundly social experiences. And, you know, many people today worry that we have these intimate romantic relationships with our iPads and iPhones, and that we neglect each other. And I'm concerned about that too, except that the best research we have so far says that people who are heavy users of those communications technologies are actually more likely to spend time with friends face-to-face, more likely to spend time with neighbors, more likely to go out into public and engage with strangers, other people. So I think those concerns can be overblown.
Well, they help us keep in touch with those we already know, but for those of us who only know through electronic media, does it instead, do you think, foster a kind of superficiality of relationships?
There's certainly lots of superficial relationships in the world today. In fact, I think that's one reason why so many people are enjoying living alone, because they're so connected all the time to thousands of friends on Facebook they've never met, for instance, that being alone at home is a nice way to decompress. So no doubt there's a lot of superficial interaction, but a lot of people are using social media to meet new people. Think about dating sites, for instance, or all the meetups that elderly people I interviewed are starting to use as a way of connecting with other people in their situation who could provide companionship.
You also say, you know, living in cities, the mass urbanization actually encouraged people to live alone. It's a fascinating part of this book, Going Solo, Eric Kleiningberg, in which you talk about the change in the actual physical structure, I mean, the creation of new kinds of housing for people who are living alone.
In 1950, living alone was most prevalent in the big, sprawling western states like Alaska and Nevada and Wyoming. Today, it is primarily an urban phenomenon. Cities across this country have high, high levels of living alone. Places that might surprise you, like Atlanta and Denver and Minneapolis and Cleveland, Seattle, San Francisco, all those cities have rates of living alone. 40% of all households or more are one-person households. In Manhattan, where I live, and in Washington, D.C., it's almost one in two households. And, of course, that understates the amount of living alone you'd find in certain areas, because there are neighborhoods where it's 60 or 70% of all households, and single people move to those places precisely because they want to be surrounded by other singles and singletons. They want to live alone, but also be together, and cities make that possible.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with sociologist Eric Kleiningberg about living alone and liking it, not just in the U.S., but around the world. His book is Going Solo, out from Penguin Press. And now the final social change. I mean, I think it's probably obvious to most of us. We know that women tend to live longer than men do, so even women who were married become widows. and there are widowers. So living longer means more people living alone. But this is also a very interesting part. This is where it becomes maybe not so easy to live alone as we would like it to be.
Well, I don't think it's ever easy to live alone. I think living is difficult in general. And we tend to overstate the problems with living alone, but we shouldn't think that it's an easy thing. When you're aging alone, it can become dangerous. If you are old but you maintain your health and vitality, you can live alone and engage the world in really exciting ways. And I have to say, I interviewed so many older women who were so much more satisfied with their lives than they expected to be once they started living alone. They really were terrified that losing their husbands would be the end of the good life, and they were amazed at how well they were living. At the same time, the minority of older people who wind up getting isolated can find themselves in really horrific situations, and men especially do a weaker job of staying connected to friends and family than women, and they're more likely to be vulnerable and isolated. So it is time, with the boomer generation aging, as we are poised to have more and more older Americans living alone, it is time to start investing our energy and our resources into developing new kinds of housing that will allow people to live alone but also to be connected.
Well, one type of housing which is already being done are these kinds of elder living communities where you have to put in $200,000 or $300,000 to get in, and then you're basically set. You can be there in independent living. You can get to the point even if you need a full-time nursing care. But that comes to my larger question, which is this really a question of class? I mean, aren't many people now in the Great Recession moving back in with other family members because they've lost their home? Elderly people, who don't have that kind of cash, really can't move into those places. What do we do about that?
This is a question of class. There's no question about that. It's affluent and middle-class people who are able to afford living alone. It's a kind of luxury. It's not equally distributed in the population. And you are right to say that the assisted living facilities that I describe in the book are impossibly expensive for the of us, and this is the very point I make. You talked about $200,000 to $300,000 to get in. That's just from the start. You can pay $80,000 or $100,000 a year for an assisted living facility that gives you all the things that you would want for yourself or for your loved ones as they get older. And let's face it, for most people, that is impossible. And even for very affluent families, it can drain them of their resources quite quickly. So surprisingly, rates of living alone have not gone down since the recession started. There are more Americans living alone in 2012 than there were in 2008. What's changed is that fewer young people are able to live alone, young adults, but the change has been quite modest, from 12% of young adults under 30 to 11%. Compare that to 1% in 1950, and you can see how much has changed for young adults, too.
We're talking with Eric Kleinenberg about his terrific new book, Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Now, one of the things I loved in this book is, I'm very well aware of the research that has said that married people are happier and healthier than people who are not married, who are alone. And I remember when I read that, I said, well, that's funny. I'm pretty happy. It doesn't describe me. I'm a singleton. You also have reason to question that research.
Well, a lot of the research that compares married people and unmarried people skips some things. So, for instance, often it will compare people who are currently married with people who never got married. And this is a problem because, well, first of all, it throws out all the people who got married and then got divorced, or got married and then became widows or widowers. So it understates the problems, the health problems related to having a bad marriage. And they tend to report as if getting married is the solution to people's health problems and longevity concerns and concerns about financial security Staying married might be good for that, but getting married, you know, certainly is not. Moreover, the group of people who are never married includes all kinds of people, including, you know, some people who are very healthy and are opting into living alone, and other people who are quite sick or mentally ill and who are not real candidates for marriage. And so to group them all together is to skew the sample.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for women too, I think there's been some subsequent research, and I believe you also talk about that in the book, that married women are not necessarily happier or healthier than their single counterparts.
It's a painful point for me to make as a man, and a married one at that. But we know that men get the lion's share of the marriage benefits. It's pretty clear that men benefit from the social labor of women in marriages, but the evidence that women benefit is weaker. They do benefit economically from good marriages, and they can benefit with access to good health care if they don't have it on their own. But in many other respects, marriage can be quite taxing for women. And of course, if you're a woman and your husband gets very sick and you become his caretaker, that can be stressful and damaging for you as well. If you become a widow, that experience is bad for your health too. In fact, one thing that was surprising to me and to many people, I think, is that people who are never married do quite well on the happiness measures that we conventionally use to assess quality of life.
We're talking to sociologist Eric Lenningberg about his book, Going Solo. And yet, the one big downside, I think, for living alone, even almost at any income level, is that you have less financial resources because you're just simply not with another person to pull them. And this can be difficult. Talk a little bit about what kinds of things do we need to change? What are some ways in which society, now that more of us are living alone, society could actually support us?
Well, one thing would be to continue changing our attitudes and trying to eliminate the stigma around living alone that still makes it a painful experience for a good many people. We have come a long way. You know, in 1957, psychologists at University of Michigan did a study in which they discovered that 80% of Americans thought that adults who wanted to be single were either sick, neurotic, or immoral. And so we've obviously come a long way since 1957. Our attitudes have changed, but not entirely, and people still do suffer with stigma. From the policy perspective, I'm most concerned about what to do for people who are older and frail or sick and alone, people who really suffer from isolation, which is a serious health hazard. We need better housing. We need better services to people who are home alone and have trouble getting around, more access to good health care, more specialized public transportation. When we save money during economic downturns by slashing programs to support the homebound elderly, by giving them frozen meals on wheels instead of hot meals with a live human being every day, when we do those things, we're cold ourselves. It's not just the food that's cold. It's we ourselves who become cold. And I think we need to think seriously about all this.
You live in New York City. You mentioned, you know, New York had long had a reputation of being a great place to grow old. But I know that many of those programs, even the programs to help elder people get around, the buses that are used, the vans, you know, those kinds of services to reach out to the homebound elderly were cut.
They have been cut across the country. And when times get tough economically, cities and states often will slash their budgets for support programs for the most frail and isolated people, old people. I think that this is terribly short-sighted and cruel, in fact. Short-sighted because none of us can really say with confidence, however we live today, whether we're married or single, that in 5 or 10 or 20 or 50 years, that we will have someone there with us, taking care of us. We all face the possibility in the contemporary world that we will wind up living alone and aging alone. And it's in all of our interest to make that as good an experience as it can be.
And do you think it's cost effective?
it's cost effective to provide services for older people?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on what the effect is. It can be expensive to provide subsidized health care or to provide subsidized housing, to provide all the services that people who live alone need. But what's the alternative? If the alternative is to let people suffer isolated and in kind of misery, this is not what we want. I end the book with a chapter on redesigning solo life, in which I look closely at various models for doing supportive housing more effectively. I go to Sweden and Stockholm, where more than 60% of households are one-person households, and look at one housing facility where they allow people to move in if they are single and living alone above the age of 40. So it's not above the age of 65, because who wants to live in a geriatric ghetto? Above the age of 40, so there's mixed generations. And they have a common kitchen area, a quite large and attractive one on the first floor, encased in glass, a very pleasant place to be. Adjacent to it is a quite large dining room that looks a little bit like a restaurant. And every morning, residents sign up if they want to eat dinner there that night, and they take turns cooking together for each other. So they help each other. They give each other more time. They give each other companionship. It's a great arrangement, and it's the kind of thing we should be doing more often here, too.
Yeah, it sounded absolutely wonderful.
You're ready to move to Stockholm.
I am.
It gets very cold in the winter and quite dark, too, so
be
careful.
Global warming will take care of that.
Oh, no.
You also talk about some experiments in redesigning living for low-income singletons in New York City redesigning SROs. Those are pretty interesting, too.
There's a woman named Roseanne Haggerty who founded an organization called Common Ground, and they said, what if we designed hotel residences, these one-room, single-room occupancy dwellings for poor people in cities? What if we designed them with real attention to what makes a place feel good? What if we made them clean and more open and brought in more light? What if we had nicer common facilities and better security? Couldn't we make the lives of people who are very poor and wind up living alone much better also? And they have built buildings throughout Manhattan, now building a major complex in Brooklyn in the Bed-Stuy neighborhood, and they become a model for high-quality housing in cities around the world. We need to learn from our best examples.
Well, the book is absolutely fascinating and a lot of fun to read, especially for those of us, and that's, as you're saying, is it could well become a majority who are going solo, and that's the extraordinary rise and surprising appeal of living alone. Eric Kleinenberg, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Eric Kleinenberg is professor of sociology, public policy, and media culture and communications at New York University and editor of the journal Public Culture. In addition to going solo, he's the author of Fighting for Air, which we spoke to him about in a previous show, and Heat Wave. You can read an excerpt from Going Solo at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.